This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. In December, Colorado's state Supreme Court ruled that former President Donald Trump is ineligible for the presidency because of his involvement in the January 6th, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Therefore, the court ruled he should not be listed as a candidate on the presidential primary ballot in the state. That ruling was put on hold pending appeal. Trump's legal team did appeal that decision. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case and is set to make a decision sometime soon, which will determine whether Colorado and other states could remove Trump from the ballot. Our next guest is an expert in election law and has been following the case closely. He joins us for a look at the legal arguments on both sides and what it could mean for the election this year and maybe in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with Colorado's decision to remove Trump from the ballot, or do you think it was overstepping? What are you hoping to see come out of the U.S. Supreme Court? What questions do you have about what's going on legally and constitutionally here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Derek T. Muller is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School, where his research focuses on election law. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the twists and turns here, let's start with the basis for this argument. It's one of the post-Civil War amendments banning insurrectionists from holding office. Tell us a little bit about that law and why it, or that constitutional amendment, and why it's being brought up now.
Sure. So a lot of times we think about Civil War and some of the amendments that came out of that Civil War that abolished slavery or guaranteed the right to vote regardless of race. But other provisions have gone with a little less scrutiny in recent years until maybe this case. And one of those is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment has a number of provisions, including guarantees of due process and equal protection. But one of those provisions prohibits those who have previously taken an oath to support the Constitution of the United States and then turned around and engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States from holding future federal or state office. That's greatly simplified. There's a lot of dispute about some of the terms. But I think the concern after the Civil War is that you have a number of people who were in state legislatures or even in Congress who had taken an oath to support the Constitution and then had betrayed that oath. They were participating in the Confederacy. They attempted to secede from the Union. They fought in a war for years against that Union. And the notion was that those individuals in particular are unusually culpable. They'd taken that oath, they'd breached that oath, and therefore they should be prohibited from taking office again. And while it had some force after the Civil War, it hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention in the last 130 years until the last couple of years.
We had a couple of legal articles by conservative law scholars saying, hey, this older constitutional amendment does indeed apply to former President Trump. The slight majority on the Colorado Supreme Court agreed. Can you sum up for us the argument that, yes, in fact, as this court agreed, that yes, in fact, the 14th Amendment does apply to Donald Trump?
Sure. It's hundreds of pages of articles that have been written in the last few months. So we'll see what we can do. I mean, I think the heart of the article, and there's a number of provisions that you kind of have to get through, but I think the heart of what drew some of these authors to this point is what is an insurrection and what does it mean to engage in an insurrection? And in their view, and again, proponents of the view who are trying to keep Trump off the ballot suggest that January 6th, 2021 rose to the level of what we could define as an insurrection. That is, it was a use of force. It's a public use of force for a public purpose to prevent Congress from counting electoral votes. It was violent. It was an uprising. And it was the kind of thing that, while not the scale of the Civil War, certainly fits within the text of that provision of the Constitution. And Trump's speech on January 6th at the Ellipse, just a few short steps away from the Capitol, helped incite the crowd to go march on the Capitol. He used words like fight to get them there, and then did nothing and sort of sat on the sidelines as this mob breached the Capitol and rioted and disrupted the counting of electoral votes. So in their view, at least the proponents' view, that Trump was culpable, he engaged in insurrection, and as a result, he is barred from holding office.
A lot of questions by the time this hits the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems like one that the justices focused on in oral arguments was who decides if this applies. And it seems like the justices were leaning toward not the states. A state can't necessarily do this. Can you talk about that aspect of the argument here?
Yeah, there are lots of wrinkles to think about this. So states had been enforcing this against state officials right after the Civil War. They thought that state legislators were ineligible and might refuse to seat them. But when it comes to federal officials, we think about this maybe a little bit differently. For members of Congress, we think that Congress typically judges the qualifications of candidates, not states. And there was some worry on the court that why should one trial judge in Colorado sit down in a hearing and make a bunch of factual determinations and essentially say that this candidate is not qualified in a way that has tremendous implications across the United States and would stand and perhaps have force elsewhere unless the United States Supreme Court stepped in and told them otherwise. So while we think about presidential elections having this national scope, they're formally happening on a state-by-state basis, and Colorado's argument was, well, we can do what we want in our state. But the Supreme Court seemed very skeptical of this and a suggestion that they were trying to interfere with a federal election, with a potential future federal officer, and that before they did so, maybe we would need Congress to step in and provide some kind of guidance. But there are lots of different ways that the court could go, but they seemed very disturbed with the notion that one state could have such an outsized influence in a presidential election.
One argument over this clause, Derek, is whether it's self-enforcing. And I've seen the analogy to, okay, there's an age limit to run for president. If I tried to run for president back when I was 25, I wouldn't have met the age limit. I would have automatically been off. States would have been within their rights to keep me off the ballot, I guess. The argument that, well, it's in the Constitution now, the insurrection clause is self-enforcing, doesn't need Congress to pass it. How strong is that argument?
I mean, the justices had a few different approaches or worries about this. So one was Chief Justice Roberts saying that the 14th Amendment, as a structural matter, is designed to limit state power, right? We just come out of a civil war. We're very skeptical of state power. The 14th Amendment says things like no state shall deprive any person of due process, or equal protection of the laws. So these are limitations on states. So it seems strange to think that Section 3 gives states power without some sort of mechanism for Congress to step in. Another is to say, well, the word insurrection is a big word. And unlike age, which we can determine right, pretty quickly and easily without dispute, determining what was an insurrection and whether someone engaged into it is a much messier matter that suggests we need some congressional guidance. And finally, there was a point made that right after ratification of this provision in 1869, a Supreme Court justice who was then on a lower court suggested in a different kind of case, and there's a lot of controversy around it, to suggest, I'm not going to do this on my own. We need Congress to step in and provide some guidance. And Congress has passed some statutes in the past to figure out how to remove officials who you believe have engaged in insurrection. They've repealed some of those statutes in the past. And one of the arguments from Trump's legal team is you need to respect what Congress has done. Congress might pass statutes, it might repeal them, but we need to defer to the congressional process, at least when it comes to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Talking to Derek Muller, professor of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School, looking at this ballot challenge to former President Trump under an insurrection clause in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Roy is with us in Racine. Roy, hi.
Hey there.
What did you want to bring up, Roy?
I just think, has anybody so far actually been charged with insurrection? Because for me, from my perspective, I see Black Lives Matter riots and the January 6th riots as just riots. A dissatisfied people dissatisfied with a rather undemocratic government.
Roy, thanks a lot for the call. Derek, a lot of people have been charged with the January 6th I won't call it insurrection, riots, if you want to call it that for now, at the Capitol. But Roy says, are they being charged with insurrection or something different?
Yeah, so that there's a provision of the United States Code 2383, which is the Insurrection Act. It was actually first passed before the 14th Amendment during the Civil War. It's been updated a little bit since then, and no one has been charged under the Insurrection Act. Donald Trump was not charged by the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, on this provision. And one of Trump's arguments is to say this is the way that Congress wants us to resolve things, by charging and criminally convicting people through the Insurrection Act. And if you're not going to do that, that you're not going to accept the method that Congress has taken, states can't do their own thing. So that is an argument in his favor. On the other side, people would point out, look, after the Civil War, a lot of former Confederates were not charged with insurrection. They were not criminally convicted. It's just sort of a matter of fact that they supported the United States or the Confederacy against the United States during the Civil War, and therefore should be excluded from office. So part of it is this difficulty of thinking about what does it mean to have this provision on the books? Are we supposed to use that because Congress says that's the only basis to do so? Or is it acceptable for states to use their own processes and enforce the guarantees of the Constitution on their own without some explicit guidance from Congress saying you're forbidden from doing that?
Thanks for that call, Roy. And Roy echoes something from the Trump legal team here, saying this is more like a riot, less than a rebellion, and comparing it to, say, a Black Lives Matter riot. The counter argument, I think, is if it's a riot with the intention of overturning the results of an election, does that become something more than a riot? Is this something that the courts are wrestling with?
Yeah, again, the Supreme Court didn't seem to want to spend too much time on defining what an insurrection was or getting into the events of January 6th. I think if you read some of the historical briefing, they would say there has to be some sort of public purpose or sort of public resistance to government or something like that. So you could imagine that in some other riots that have taken place in the United States, if somebody is throwing Molotov cocktails into a courthouse or something like that, there might be things that we would say rise to this level of resistance and force against the entity, the government itself. But part of it is that there are disputes about what kinds of conduct is violent enough to rise to this level. Again, none of these things are nearly at the scale of the Civil War. Another is to say the facts of any given outbreak or occurrence or violence, what kinds of things rise to that level. So again, it is a challenge. It's an underused provision of the Constitution. And so we are exploring it for the first time or first time in recent memory and debating its meaning.
Talking to Derek T. Muller, professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, with us for a look at the latest in the case Trump versus Anderson. That's the case before the U.S. Supreme Court that's going to decide whether Colorado could remove former President Trump from the ballot in the 2024 presidential election, opening up the possibility for other states to do the same. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this case? Do you think it's going to end up being significant, or do you expect it to just be overturned and we're back to our regularly scheduled election? What decision are you hoping to see? What questions do you have about the many legal and constitutional wrinkles here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with University of Notre Dame law professor Derek T. Muller about the Trump ballot case currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. We had some oral arguments last week, set to be decided when they're ready to decide it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this? Who should get to decide if a presidential candidate, or other candidate for that matter, violates this insurrection clause in the 14th Amendment? Join in at 800-642-1234. Derek, before we go back to our callers, you know, I never try to predict the outcome of what the U.S. Supreme Court's going to decide. I don't ask other people to. Based on questioning, it sure seems like they're going to slap down the Colorado Supreme Court on this, though. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was broad consensus on that point, to the point sort of you raised earlier about the notion about one state weighing in on this and affecting the whole political process. Yeah, it is hard to figure this out from oral argument itself. But whenever a plaintiff has a claim like the voters have here, they have to win on every single issue. In order for Trump to win, he just has to win on one. And so when his attorney got up there, there were different justices who were pressing back on various parts of the argument. But there's no question that when the respondents were up there, the court seemed to coalesce around this view, at least eight justices and perhaps all nine, that the Supreme Court should not be involved in this process and that Colorado shouldn't be. So how they exactly get there remains to be seen. I think it'll be in the very near future, but I think all signs point to some pretty broad consensus that Trump's name will remain on the ballot.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I guess my question is, if one is to take the position that this seems to lend too much power to one state to make a decision, when we look at recent Supreme Court rulings, and I'll just use Dobbs as a kind of one of recent fact, which seems to shift more power back into the state's position, how do you reconcile this argument? And two, when they do rule, do you believe that there will be a per curiam decision, or do you think we'll see a series of individual?
Chris, thanks for the call. That first point, Derek, seeing a trend toward the Supreme Court giving more power to states, this could push back in the other direction, he says. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think part of it is that different provisions of the Constitution could give more or less power to states in different areas. And I think if you were to ask justices on the court, they would explain that they have consistent views on these points. But there's no question that in some places, like Dobbs, the jurisprudence has been this is a matter for states to decide, not the courts. And there's a likelihood in this case that the court says, no, this is a national interest. There's a national scope here, and state power is limited. So I think that's certainly true. And Justice Kagan in particular, at oral argument, was pressing this view and suggested that the Supreme Court for 50 years, actually, when it comes to other election law cases about presidential elections, has said states have less of an interest in presidential elections and their regulations simply because the office is national in nature. So you can find some trends on this case stretching back again for some time. But you have to start parsing out which parts of the Constitution you think are more state-specific, which you think are more federal-specific, and what the relationship is between the two.
And thanks for the call, Chris. I looked up Chris's lat there. Per curiam, meaning by the court. So will the court issue a decision that's just by the court, not signed by one justice, or are we going to see a lot of different takes? Of course, we won't know till we see it. Your thoughts on what we might see, Derek?
Yeah, I mean, most famously, to think about Bush versus Gore in 2000, where the Supreme Court wrote per curiam, and you didn't see any one justice's name attached to that decision. But, you know, several justices wrote several opinions, some of them in dissent, one of them concurring. So I think there's a question right now about what this looks like on the Supreme Court. On the one hand, you have some people, Justice Thomas was on the court during Bush versus Gore. Others litigated some of these issues, like Justice Kavanaugh, in the trenches as a lawyer in 2000. I think they realized that it doesn't look great for the court to have so many fractured opinions. And if there is broad consensus, could you have a per curiam without any name attached? At the same time, you know, justices might have strong views in some of the other issues in this case, and they might want to write separately. So I do anticipate the majority opinion will come out relatively quickly and would likely be a per curiam opinion. But it remains to be seen how much the court is able to hold everyone together and how many people might feel compelled to write their own pieces on the side.
Thanks, Chris, for calling in. Will joins us now in Seymour. Will, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hey, Rob, the way that I see this, I think that there's definitely a case to be made that Trump could be ineligible for the presidency with a conviction of insurrection. But I think it has to be that it has to be a conviction of a specifically defined crime or some kind of wrongdoing, because otherwise it's more of a matter of partisan opinion of following more the spirit of the law than the letter. And this is a case where you really have to stick to the letter of the law, is what I believe.
Will, thanks a lot for the call. And I've seen that argument elsewhere, Derek, the idea that, okay, if we're going to say somebody is guilty of insurrection, we better prove them to be guilty of insurrection in a court.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the arguments that Trump pressed, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court was also concerned about this, is that one state having a hearing and admitting some expert testimony or reviewing some tweets, as has happened with Trump on January 6th, that's not a great position to define the term insurrection and to conclude that somebody's responsible for it. And if there's some dispute or some fights about it, you have to bring it back to the United States Supreme Court, which might have to get involved if these questions start to arise with increasing frequency and we start to have more disputes about what an insurrection is. And then we're asking the Supreme Court to revisit these questions. With a criminal case, you have a much longer window to introduce evidence. You have a much higher burden of proof, and you have a much cleaner resolution. And again, for Colorado, they're saying, well, that's okay. That's one way of doing it. But we think there should be other ways as well. Again, it's not clear that the Supreme Court buys that argument, but again, we'll see what the opinion says when it comes down.
Time for one more caller. Tony is with us in Ironwood. Hi, Tony.
Hey, I listened carefully to the arguments, and you know, I thought about the state right concept of you know, them deciding who they want on their ballot, and then I think that it was sort of tossed aside when one of the attorneys said, "Well, we would decide, and then you, the Supreme Court, would decide if we were right." And I thought, "Well, boy, that's really burdensome. How do you do that?" You know, and everybody would have separate trials, 50 different trials, if they wanted. So I think that the issue then is sort of along the lines of standing, that, you know, it didn't happen in Colorado. If this insurrection claim was to be made, it would have to be brought up where it happened. And then if there were anything to be reviewed about, you know, the validity of the findings of that trial, then it could go to the Supreme Court. See, he's not even charged with insurrection. So it's sort of, how do they come to that? And then
I got Tony, we're just about out of time. Thanks for calling in. Derek, could you talk about the possible outcome of if the Supreme Court would open it up to individual states to make this decision, just in our last, half a minute or so?
No. Yeah, Colorado would keep them off the ballot. Maine already has, and some other states might follow suit. But it's worth noting that states don't have an obligation to do that. They might want to keep him on the ballot. But I think what it would set up for is a very, very messy summer in Milwaukee as the Republican National Committee gathers together for its convention and deciding, should we keep off this candidate who might be off the ballot in at least some states? And that would be its own separate political nightmare.
Derek, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Derek T. Muller, professor of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. His research there focuses on election law. And we've been talking about this case before the U.S. Supreme Court that'll decide whether or not former President Trump appears on ballots for the presidential race in the general election this fall. That after a Colorado Supreme Court ruling saying, yeah, we could keep him off because of a constitutional clause. Tomorrow on the Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, new inflation numbers are out. What does it mean for the economy and for you? Join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network.